medicinal and recreational marijuana operations. Greg Buck. All yours.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We're back here for the second installment of background information and building a code package, if you will, for recommendation to the city council. And there are handouts this evening. With the short turnaround, we were not able to commit all these to electronic and put through the standard process and get them out to you gentlemen. But what you have before you are two examples of code language where, as we'll discuss later, we're having a little trouble finding people that are out in front of the curve doing adoption. But it looks as though Ashland has waded into the fray, and Ben has something, I believe, that went through on an emergency and is already adopted. They will just be reference materials tonight, and we can, I think, the Bend code, by no coincidence, resembles our code a bit, given the number of former Springfield staff on employee of the city of Bend now. So I think that'll be quite helpful when we try to walk through some of the examples. We have, I put together a draft of the work items that we discussed last week. They were attached to the AIS, and there were 8 items, and we had some discussion about those, and we'll try to follow up on some of those questions tonight. And then we have the first, albeit rough draft of the what will be our code proposal, and it'll be surrounded, if you will, by process and procedure and an AIS and a recommendation for motions and background information and statutory attachments, and may blow up to about, you know, 100 pages or more in the full and complete package. But our code right now, for purposes I can only believe our encryption or anti-encryption, is the one that has the two abbreviated draft watermarks on it. And this is the code section that we included in your previous package as reference material of what we were doing with dispensaries. And I have begun to craft our discussion into that. And the sooner we get it to Mary Bridget for legal review, the better off we'll be. And my my draft will, of course, will put it together with Mr. Mott and council, and we'll eventually forward that on to council. So that's kind of the game plan tonight. I was hoping, since we gave an extra half an hour last time we met, that we might get through this and get some direction or the next round of questions, and be able to refine that after your break into that code package. And we'll be moving it down the pipeline for adoption. We'll talk about timelines and dates perhaps at the end of the meeting.
I'm missing that document.
This one?
The copy. No, the RF.
Oh, our code one. Yeah. Very good, sir. I probably took yours. So, in that regard, I guess kind of the game plan, we could use the staff's, the status of draft work items document, which is the small spreadsheet, answer questions, use the Bend examples as necessary, and the city of Ashland, which is fairly new to me. It was kind of brought forward by a newspaper article by Gino, who keeps an eye on things down there. We'll do that as necessary. So if you will, unless the chair would like to add, subtract, delete, or revise that approach, with your permission, Mr. Chair, Chair-elect, and Vice-Chair-elect. I only get to say that so many times. item one was the zoning and medical, zoning of medical and recreational activities. And as we left off last week, I understood that we had some head nods and consistent with council's idea that the general zoning that we had discussed in terms of industrial and commercial was fairly straightforward. And I think we all reached a discussion that our mission here is that straightforward zoning, mitigating conditions as necessary. So just quickly across the line, we're going to be codifying the zoning based on that council discussion, and that package will be brought forward to you for your final recommendation. And that, as I mentioned, with the city attorney, and at our next meeting, with the benefit of a break, hopefully the draft document, which we'll review later, will be ready. The daycare buffers was the next item that was on the council and transcribed here. Residential is generally covered in the residential buffering, as we spoke. The only map that I brought tonight is a full zoning map, and the 50-foot buffer, as we discussed, is shown on that residential. And you'll recall where we were using that 50-foot buffer with its impact on the adjacent properties. There may be other buffer discussions before we churn through all of the industrial tonight, too. We'll have some more discussions. But that has 1,000 feet on the schools. It has 1,000 feet, I believe, on the parks. Sorry. I've got to stand up. My eyes are not as good as my memory. We did put childcare on there. Okay, the top one is school and childcare facilities, and then we have the residential 50-foot, and we did add the school property down on Jasper for as an unmarked new addition. Additional buffers in the daycare. We stop individually here as we go through these, or we can circle back after we just get through the spreadsheet and get comments. Your choice. In Bend, they put a 150-foot buffer around daycare, and if you want to, right now we can review that section of their code. It's pretty straightforward. Comes under their special use standards. They use code structures similar to ours. They have a spreadsheet of permitted uses, discretionary uses, site plan review required, and then they, after their discussion, landed on 150-foot for daycares commercially licensed. And I'm not certain what the majority of the Planning Commission's opinion is on that. Staff's opinion is that I have a hard time writing findings and factual information to support the reasoning for a buffer from daycares. I think we briefly discussed what possible impacts could come from someone driving past a dispensary or a commercial retail outlet on their way to their daycare. I think we had crossed the line a little bit into the security and safety, perhaps, was maybe the real underlying reason. But there, I'm at a loss a bit for any hard statistics for that buffer. I did do some searching myself, and then I checked with Chief Doney to see if I had missed anything in my considerable Google skills. And using the internet, using the League of Oregon Cities, using all available official information sources, and then checking with the chief, it's very difficult to find any solid statistical information with regard to crime, safety. I think ultimately, you know, this is a cash business that adds to the discussion. There may be a security or a safety concern in the back of our minds. I think we're talking about what could happen if there was a serious crime at one of these places and it wasn't some distance from a daycare, which all makes fairly good sense. until you kind of start to scrutinize it and look for supporting evidence. The chief told me, as we surmised last week, it's way too early for any hard data. You can't get it from Oregon and Washington, or from Colorado and Washington even. And certainly, you know, the chief said he could probably work and produce maybe a scatter map of any crimes that were, or calls from the dispensaries, but it would not be very scientific, include any analysis. It would be simply calls to the dispensaries, and that's kind of the limit of what we have at our disposal. So it's
Jim?
Yes.
And just to kind of add to that, as a reminder, the OLCC rules require recreational dispensaries particularly to have security plans, lighting, only be open certain times of the day. They also have to not allow minors. They have to have signs posted. So they're pretty secure facilities anyway. And they have those extra rules no matter where they're located. So it's something to think about in terms of buffers, what you're trying to accomplish with the buffer.
But you did say recreational dispensaries, which is a contradiction in terms.
Oh, I'm sorry, recreational retail. Not a dispensary.
Not a dispensary.
Yeah. Suffice to say, and help me out here if I go astray from, they both have considerable security standards in their separate bodies of law. So staff's recommendation, you know, and we'll take any direction from this body that you want to recommend as your, at your majority, but writing findings that sort of can identify daycare users, daycare populations as somewhat of a more at-risk body than any other general public, given the location of these in general commercial zones where lots of business is conducted, is a bit of a challenge. We can work harder at trying to come up with something along those lines. But I guess I would take my lead from you gentlemen on what you think is reasonable and practical. And
you seem to feel comfortable thinking it's not much of a problem, realistically.
I think there is no data to support that that population using a daycare is at any more risk than the general population surrounding one of these retail outlets. I mean, frankly, gentlemen, if we're talking about a child getting hit by a stray bullet during an armed robbery because this is a cash business in the commercial zone, there are other high-dollar cash.
Could be a 7-Eleven.
Could be a jewelry store, was the analogy that came up in discussion. Today, high dollar, small, easy, portable. They're all over our commercial zoning districts. You know, the analogy fails me when I try to conceive, you know, legal findings and stand that sort of information. So, more work or?
So staff's recommendation really was 50 feet, isn't that correct from those daycare facilities, the same as it would be from residential?
Right.
That's my recollection.
We felt that the 50-foot buffer already on the residential zoning districts would
covers that.
The home, and I may have been not perfectly clear, I felt that that covered all of the home daycares, and I was kind of staff at your disposal on the commercial daycares. Like I said, we have evidence on the table that Ben did 150 feet. Other people have done no buffers. So staff, this staff's personal opinion is, in the marketplace, this business has a couple of characteristics, but not enough to make it any different than other businesses in the marketplace. And the need to protect them from daycare is tough to support. I can't say that it's irrelevant or inadvisable, but I can say it's a bit of a stretch in writing findings based on the evidence that I've seen.
Seems fine to me. I mean, there's bars right next to, my son used to go to the Montessori, and the bar's right next door. So, I mean, you have drunk drivers and whatever coming out of there, so.
I did a little bit of research. About the only ones that really came up with a lot of statistics was Colorado, and their crime rate is about half as what it is around banks.
That would be consistent with some of the information I saw. The Colorado example was that they had increasing crime before they approved recreational, and in general, crime continued to increase, but there was some evidence that marijuana violations had gone down, obviously, because it was now not a crime. And so there was offsetting information, and frankly, I saw a clear dividing line based upon the source. If you were totally in favor of decriminalization and recreational and everything, I saw information one way. And then if you were on the other side of that line and you felt that it was a problem, or maybe you didn't vote for it in the statewide election, I saw information carrying sort of that conviction. So again, in terms of real hard statistical information, the chief and I both were left wanting.
Just a quick process check for me. The Planning Commission, is it true that the Planning Commission will hold a public hearing, or is that going to be City Council, or will it be Planning Commission and City Council?
I think we should have a public hearing, take testimony from the public, do a resolution for your recommendation to council, and mm-hmm. I think that would be...
you're thinking a public hearing would be the City Council level, but not the Planning Commission level?
I guess I'm questioning whether we're precluded from having taken some public testimony prior to the recommendation to council.
I think the way I saw it coming together is you'd have two work sessions, you make recommendations, and then it would go to the council, they would have a public hearing, and then adopt. But we can talk
about it. So really, we're not going to have any public testimony, direct public testimony, mm-hmm. in regards to our presentation under that scenario.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Do you agree with that, or are you...
Well, I'm thinking that we're locked into a specific hearing protocol for code amendments, and that the Planning Commission is required to conduct a public hearing.
I can look that up if you want to continue your discussion about certain things.
That's important from my standpoint, because I think, to bring forward a recommendation to council mm-hmm. without at least opening things up for public testimony, we're presuming that the child care community doesn't have an issue with this. And, and I think having that public input, if we get no input and there are no concerns raised during that process, I think that's a telling factor for us. And I think that's one of our roles, is to take that public input. It's difficult for me to make a recommendation. I mean, I can presume, and I represent a portion of the public. I have my own viewpoint, but I certainly am not running a daycare facility. I think that's an important element. We certainly could cobble together a recommendation based on staff's input and this information you've provided to us. But, Bend has said 150 feet. Why? Is my first question. And I look at their findings in this information, and their findings really don't tie back. I mean, they just really say, this is kind of what everybody else is doing, so this is what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what we need, just to kick the can down the road. I mean, we're going to probably, at some point, we're going to have to come back and revisit these things, potentially.
They're being safe by specifying something.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think public opinion matters, daycare opinion matters, and there may be evidence, perhaps, that they have that, we just haven't found.
Exactly.
So I would just offer that there's public opinion, and then there's statistical evidence.
Right.
And hopefully, we would get some of both.
Right.
So we will review that process and take testimony.
Code amendments are type 4.
And we'll probably have that sort of general structure question for you here shortly.
A lot of people have been talking about the concern with the cash. Did Colorado eventually make up like a state-run bank? So I thought I read once that, because the money can't be deposited, so then they created a state-run bank, so then there was some type of, I guess, protection. I don't know. You guys know anything about that?
I have not gone into that sort of general commerce angle of it yet, but can certainly run that down too, because I have heard similar rumor.
Because there was going to be a bank that started up in Oregon, but then they got cold feet and they took off, because I was up in Portland on a meeting with the commercial end of it, so.
Again, we serve, you know, and, you know, certainly we try to bring you as much information and expertise as we can, but if that's the commission's will, we'll look further into that. We'll answer the question on the hearing here as well. While that is going on, if there's another question or input on this one, we could look at number 3 briefly and consider the impacts of use on utilities and surrounding properties. I think we as staff had offered that the development review process will be required. So somewhere on the continuum of land use compatibility statement, minimum development standards, site plan review, et cetera, we would be looking at the standard impacts. The question for us becomes some of the impacts on the surrounding properties and whether in addition to those standard review procedures, we want to put any special use standards on there. And we can stop at this point and look at a couple of sections of special use standards. They'll look fairly familiar again from the Bend code, if you will, if you want to have an idea, I will leave you at that to your reading. But if we want to talk about some of the industrial uses as we go through, we can always circle back around to special use standards and talk about how other jurisdictions got at that. Suffice to say, we will carry forward the requirement to do development approval and land use review and site plan review. And that should probably be codified. In some jurisdictions, it goes without saying that it's development, and then you will treat it as such. But I think we're going to be creating a brand new code, and I think it would behoove us, you know, subject to the council's approval, that we put such things as all new development is subject to chapter 5.17 site plan review standards for Springfield Development Code from the Department of Redundancy. But again, it's a brand new world, and we're trying to be infinitely clear.
Yep.
So I will just note to come back to special use here shortly.
Regarding grow sites, I had some concerns that because of pesticides that are sometimes used and fertilizers that are sometimes used, that any grow, particularly enclosed grow sites, would need to participate in the wastewater review and reporting standards, so that they're permitted to permitted discharge standards, I guess. And I'd want to make sure that they weren't willy-nilly dumping stuff into the wastewater system.
Absolutely. We can drill down into that in a standard development review. If you'll recall, when we do an engineering review with the rest of our development review team, Environmental Services, who regulates all of our state and federal permitting for discharges, can avail themselves of each and every development. We're, you know, an indoor grow site is probably going to be a preferable grow site. It's much more easy to control. You know, we can talk here shortly on in specific zones and development standards if we want to talk about limiting indoor only. That would be a special use standard. and that gives us much more control over floor materials, containment, and part of the drinking water protection overlay. So we'll be looking at the sanitary system, the stormwater system, the drinking water system, all of that, as we do in a normal development review process.
Hey, Jim.
Yes.
I can address that process question.
Sure.
If you'd like. So I misspoke earlier. So what would happen is what you're looking at now are potential code amendments to the development code, not the regular municipal code. Code amendments are what's called a Type 4 procedure, which are made by a recommendation of the Planning Commission, then a decision by the council, and it has to have an ordinance. It's a land use decision. So how that would work is we have a work session here, we'll take input from you, then we'll have an evidentiary hearing at the Planning Commission level with the new draft code amendments that based on your input, and then you'll take testimony at those, at that hearing, and then you'll make a recommendation based on that hearing and everything that came into the record about the code amendments that'll move on to council. Council would most likely have a hearing as well when they get to that level. They don't have to have a hearing, but generally they do. They may take more testimony themselves or they may not. But you are actually the evidentiary hearing body at the level of when the amendments will be recommended, and then you vote on your recommendation.
Good.
Just to clarify that.
That makes perfect sense.
Okay. Forgive me, Mayor, one more question. PC's recommendation to the council is termed a recommendation, or is it a resolution, or is it?
It just says recommendation. I think Brenda reduces it to writing, and then you sign it.
Sure, I just wanted to use the right terminology. Yeah. We have ordinances, resolutions, recommendations, and any number of other things as, you know, the situation necessitates. If I may, to get through the list first and then circle back on some of the other issues. The next one was prohibit on-site use, and I think the short answer here was to be consistent with state law. I don't know that from the Department of Redundancy we'd go so far as to restate this one. We may in the code package, but if you recall that there's no public use in recreational, and the use of medical on site is limited to cardholders in the employ in a discrete area that is not visible and protected from the general public. And we will confirm that again with legal analysis before we put the code to the public and before you for a recommendation. The code enforcement workload and safety issues, as I've termed it from the discussion and the terminology, again, it's just a reminder that we're working with 2.0 full-time employees that do the entire customer service, complaints, inspection, enforcement, and court proceedings for everything that is basically non-criminal in the city of Springfield. Citation process is what they do, and special use standards and other things where we go beyond the state statutory regulations is something that is either going to go into the municipal code or the development code and be subject to code enforcement. And I just want to be realistic and put that reminder out there as we move through this. If there's any conflict or, you know, difficulty that we see in enforcement, workload and staffing is something we discuss at budget time, and there may be a budget impact piece for what we're recommending to council, and I'm sure they'll want some sort of assessment for financial impacts of what we might be doing. 7 was mapping and buffers, and I've noted here that I should have said general, subject to your gentleman's final approval, support for the 50-foot residential buffer, that we still, we had the parks as an issue out there, and we'll be working with Bob Kiefer and his staff to get something on letterhead from them as a recommendation or a comment on what we're doing. We have the commercial and industrial. If we want to look at any buffers between uses, between industrial uses, separation standards from one from another, or separation from residential districts. Right now, I think our conversation has been somewhat limited to just protecting the single-family residential district. And then we have the safety of the extraction process. And again, I have to circle back to development review where the fire marshal and other experts are involved. These will be industrial uses. I think we can look at some code examples where some of the other processing, some of the standard stuff that goes into making edible products is done without some of the incendiary aspects, and others, even if they do involve that, they're industrial uses, I think, at the end of the day. And we'll be able to parse it out and just say that extraction by those process and procedures is only a heavy industrial use subject to the protections and regulations of development review. So that was kind of where we left the discussion on those council directed items. If we want to guide the rest of the discussion, we could review the draft code process and then refer back to any Ashland or band information. This would be, again, the RF document that, for reasons still unknown to me, why the watermark is broken into differently for each pages. But it is RF on page one, and it's DAT on page two. Again, I suspect that's some sort of encryption technique. Just to review, this was the dispensary zoning regulations before we part them for the ballot measure when it went through last year. And I have begun to recraft it as the Springfield Development Code amendments to allow medical marijuana dispensaries in certain zoning districts. And we will craft it for recreational retail facilities. They're in the four primary uses we've been discussing. And you can see at the midpoint of the first page, staff is proposing to allow medical dispensaries and recreational outlets in the community and commercial and major retail zoning districts. That is not a conclusive or exhaustive statement. We'll be looking at that zoning with you gentlemen. Prohibit medical marijuana dispensaries in the mixed use and industrial zoning districts. I have added provide appropriate zoning for the four types under recreational. Proposed buffers for consideration on separation, olfactory, daycare, parks, and other uses. And five, proposed non-conforming use protections for location require compliance with operating standards. And moving to our first zoning designation, the community commercial zoning districts. There being two separate statutory bodies of law, but one real purpose for having a dispensary or a recreational retail outlet, I simply added the marijuana retailers for recreation to the medical under one heading. So it's not allowed in neighborhood commercial. It is with a site plan, the asterisk on that page means site plan review in CC and MRC, and not allowed in the GO for reasons that, you know, we've discussed. They're in print here, and I won't go through here for the interest of brevity, but certainly on the next rendition, we'll have some additional findings in here. The findings and discussion are somewhat limited just to medical. And at your direction, I'll take any points or clarifications you'd like to make about the general zoning, but that was the approach in commercial. At 32400 at the bottom of the page, and as you flip to page 3, we are looking at the industrial zone districts. And I have added grow facilities in a generic sense, be they medical or recreational. They are not permitted in the LMI. They should be permitted, that should be a P, in heavy industrial. They are not permitted in the SHI, special heavy industrial, such as it is outside of the city limits, that zoning. And we are again limited to what is inside the city limits, and any intensification for grow or other licensed activity will be in urban use and will require annexation and development to City of Springfield standards. Processing is not permitted in the LMI. It is permitted in the HI. It's not permitted in SHI, and I will leave SHI out of the discussion for the aforementioned reason from here out. Processing, if you look at the definition of LMI as it stands today, does not include the processing of raw materials. It does include the processing of components and other things into a finished product. If we want to expand into the LMI, we will have to consider a modification of the overall zoning description and designation from the header forward with findings and conclusions of fact that substantiate our addition of processing raw materials in perhaps some limited fashion. That's an option. It's out there. Staff right now is simply saying that under the current code today, raw materials are not processed in LMI.
What is the asterisk on the B for?
That's site plan review.
Okay.
And I kept it in there. We might, under special use standards, again, if we say that everything is subject to site plan review, but that is standard nomenclature in the code for any commercial industrial. Tips people off at the counter that you don't have to go through site plan.
Got it.
Wholesale, you'll see, is permitted in the LMI and the HI. So to the extent that you can combine these places, you might have processing in the HI and you might have wholesale. It would not be, you know, outside of normal industrial process or business model to take your raw materials, process them into something, and then deliver them, you know, to retail outlets.
And industrial?
That's dark purple.
Heavy industrial.
Yes, heavy industrial. LMI would be the lighter purple that you see around.
Yeah.
I'm questioning why, Commissioner Dunn, you just had your finger on Gateway, and that should be campus industrial. And there's a very slight variation, I guess, in the light purple. One is campus, and one is light medium industrial. So just wanted to be clear about that. And recreational marijuana retailers and medical marijuana dispensaries as a primary or a secondary use, we have not permitted in the industrial districts. And that generally, before I move to campus, red flags, problems, things that don't jive with prior conversation, or just continue to move forward with this, and we'll get a little bit more into the findings and conclusions on our complete code package. Okay.
I think it's correct.
There, you know, before we leave this, I want to say, you know, it's within our purview and in the future here. LMI and HI can abut residential zoning districts, you will notice. And it is always a question of those industrial uses perhaps having an impact, and they can be somewhat, you have to expand your thinking a little bit about impacts when you have large industrial uses. And if we want to take a look at a buffer from residential or a distance from the primary structure on the industrial, or if you want to go right to the heart of the matter and address the actual impacts, the key one as we go down this road together, I think, is olfactory. And if we wanted to get at that with scrubbers or an approach that sort of addresses it right in the building, this is where you want to consider rows and all other activities will be done inside of a structure, and the exhaust therefrom could be put to technical and mechanical approaches to eliminate those odors to the extent, you know, that we can 100%. But even other uses in the industrial zoning district may not or should not be subject to significant olfactory impacts. But what I said about expanding your thinking a little bit, I will use the generic term. If a bakery goes in and you can smell that warm, wonderful bread smell for a mile to 2 miles in every direction, that may be people's cup of tea, but it may not be everyone's. And we have moved past the point in technology and other mechanical fashions where, you know, we have to just assume that that's the way it is with an industrial use. We can address those things. So before we left industrial, I wanted to reiterate that if you gentlemen want to think or discuss, you know, the distance is always a way to get at it, but it's not foolproof, as to use the bakery analogy.
We had a problem with costly coffee roasters.
Coffee roasters, yeah. Another smell that, well, outside of your olfactory personal persuasions, you know, if you have a certain asthmatic or other breathing condition, any of these smells can be a problem. So this might be an issue for public testimony, and it may come up under, you know, further in the process. So I put it out there.
How do you deal with those things now? Have we been faced with?
If I had industrial use X and it came in and it had olfactory impacts, right, I would be looking at the list of conditions of approval that staff is allowed to apply, and I'd have to make a discretionary decision with my staff to say, yeah, there's a bona fide impact on surrounding property owners. We have something that lets us address those, and we would be exercising that part of site plan review that allows us to condition a site plan. That's a discretionary process. It's something that's worked with the applicant from the very beginning, from development issues meetings to pre-submittal meetings to the land use decision, but we might very well go through an appeal because they might feel that it's somehow too much of an impact. It might have financial impacts to put scrubbers or something else on it. So we can get at it. To answer your question, Planning Commissioner, if it's a large enough impact or it's going to be repeated, it's always preferable to have some codified known process for applicants, for any business model, for anyone trying to figure out if they can do this business. The more they know, the better off we'll be, and that's why we'd be talking.
You're saying it's better to actually go ahead and codify it ahead of time rather than deal with it on a case-by-case basis. So we're saying ahead of time, yes, we know this is going to stink. You have to address this.
I do. I think if you can support that with evidence and it's just a known, you know, a reasonable person can deduce that this is going to have an olfactory impact and the technology and the mechanical solutions are out there for us. Again, we have the continuum. Sometimes just distance is enough. Sometimes just keeping it in the building is enough. And there are other times in an industrial setting where you're going to have significant exhaust. And that might also be where you go to address it.
How do you measure this? I mean, we talk about the bakery for one thing, and the roasting coffee thing was so controversial in Springfield once. I think it was almost an arson thing. They tried to burn the place down over here, and he finally moved to Glenwood. Then we have the Glenwood transfer site. All three of them in Glenwood, all of them had odors. Some of them, bakery's the only one that smells good as far as I'm concerned, but the others. But how do you measure
that? Coffee. Yeah.
It's not coffee, it's coffee roasting. It's completely different.
Well...
Something you can measure. Methane, I don't know.
Is that parts per unit of, is that how it's normally addressed?
It is to a certain degree. There's a continuum here. And some things, you know, like a landfill, may defy the logic. I just have to put that out front. There are certain public uses that you probably have to have, and maybe the standard approach wouldn't work on. But if we do have something where we have a known discharge, you know, it might be smoke, it might be the opacity factory, it might be the olfactory, you can measure at the source. And just like measuring pollutants in stormwater, you can go and you can measure parts per million. There are different measurements, but you can get at some of that. This is the part where I start to envision my code enforcement staff having one of those regulations.
Yeah, I can talk to that a little bit. So the hard part about odor is that it is technically a nuisance in our code, but the way the code reads is that a premises in such a state or condition as to cause an offensive odor or to be unsanitary. So then that gets back to what's offensive and how do you prove what's offensive.
Right.
So what other jurisdictions are, and everyone's kind of grappling with this, we've been trying to figure out what other ones are doing. Because if it's noise, you can measure noise sort of similarly. You can get have an expert come in and measure, particularly not just like super loud noise, but kind of that constant noise,
yeah,
maybe a fan or
noise.
Something would create that would be hard. So that's why it would be better to address it in the development code through a condition of approval, because then you could say, you know, smell's an issue, we have a condition of approval where this will be inside or you have some kind of ventilation or something. And then if they violate that condition of approval, that can be a code enforcement matter, which is easier to enforce than you have an offensive smell at your business, because then how does the judge, you know, really make a determination what's offensive or not? You might be able to have the complainant come in and say, I live next door and it's offensive, but a lot of times complainants don't want to be kind of neighbor against neighbor, you know, and usually code enforcement goes out and gathers the evidence. So we're still trying to figure out if there's a way we can get at odor in the context of a nuisance and code enforcement that would be easy to prove and not create a hardship on the new business and on people who are making complaints in code enforcement, but definitely understanding that with some of these businesses, if they're subject to site plan review, we could use the conditions of approval that hopefully will address some of the odor issues.
I recall there was an issue with one of the RV manufacturers and paint odors up in Coburg. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think what happened is that the city of Coburg, I believe, required the manufacturer to sample the air then.
Yeah.
So that might be something that we'd consider, so that code enforcement was, the city of Springfield was not required to buy a bunch of sampling equipment.
Right.
So if was suggested that there was an offensive odor, the business would have to prove that it was not.
That would be similar to some stormwater protection devices that we put in place, and you would have to do maintenance and you would have to do periodic testing. So if we were to require scrubbers as part of that, we certainly could include annual testing done by the applicant, by a reputable firm, to show that their exhaust was controlled. Now, at some point, as counsel points out, you may run into what exactly are you measuring. But I think if you think of it as a package where you're dealing with it at the source, you may have the building, I could condition it on a land use to be as far from the residential property as practical, but we also might want to look at a distance, a setback distance or a buffer from residential properties on industrial. Then lastly, I guess it'd be fair to put out there too, you can also limit the size of the operation. Or you could have a minimum lot size that provides you adequate room to move the building. You know, so when you think of buffers or setbacks, you can get at that one or several different ways. And one is setback from residential or having a minimum lot size. So if you have a minimum 2-acre lot or a minimum 5-acre lot, you have adequate room to move something a fair distance from the property line and put scrubbers on it. And then perhaps you will never have to go to court to enforce a parts per million measurement at the property line. That would be probably...
The only thing I wondered about is I do remember, if I may, one of the council people last week talked about this thing kind of smelling like a dead skunk, and, you know, I mean, boy, how far do you need to get away from that? I almost like your idea better of finding something, maybe what somebody else has done to measure it ahead of time and say, well, you're putting out X amount of methane or whatever.
Well, to lend a little bit of information to that rumor, there is one strain, cannabis indica, that is very common in the business, and there are multitudes of hybrids. But cannabis indica has a known sort of olfactory imprint as being similar to the smell of a skunk. So, some truth to that.
Jim, I mean, we could sit here and talk about this for another hour. And what I'm hearing is, what we really need, and what I'm hearing is staff would like, if we're going to move this direction, you'd like something codified so that you have something to fall back on. What I would say is, from a commission standpoint, we need your recommendation, okay? So bring forward a recommendation that you feel is reasonable, that will not inhibit business, but will get at this, whether it is a setback and or lot size and or some specific code that says that ventilated air or ventilated exhaust from the facility must meet a certain standard. You guys are gonna know what those standards are. And then, you know, I think then it's important for us, as if that's what we choose to consider to bring forward, we'll take the public input from the folks that are considering opening businesses and get feedback and find out where that goes, right?
Greg, noted. Greg, would it be unreasonable to add to that, you know, give us a recommendation and why that recommendation will work? Is that...
Well, you know, I think...
I mean, because if I'm the guy that's sitting at my house sitting next to some pot thing, and I'm... I got to tell you, the smell, it just conceptually scares me spitless, you know.
Well, we'll try to save time, to your point, too, Commissioner, for some residential discussion, too. But on the industrial, I guess staff would probably want to bring forth the full complement. Mm-hmm. Some combined approach.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert in business. We can talk to some of the business experts in the community even before we have the public. I'm scheduling meetings with medical access supporters, and we can do another one too with call back some of our dispensary people that helped us in the beginning that we met with, and probably talk to the industry reps a little bit and get them involved and make sure at least they're notified of our public involvement. So staff's approach would be to bring the combined approach, probably some sort of setback or size provision and the scrubbers and the technologies, and look at what's out there and been used and bring that. And
I think the other issue, and we talked about this previously, was, you know, inside grow only or inside outside. And you know, I mean, there's much more control if you grow inside, if for industrial, you know, if you're doing production. So I think, you know, I think that will need to be considered as well. And I mean, you know, the findings are going to have to support whatever direction that we go. It seems to me that there's enough probably information available to build some findings that would substantiate being able move that direction. Does that make sense?
Because that is standard zoning and impacts. And that's probably the easiest one, which is why I'm offering, I'll bring the full complement, some combined approach and...
I think he had talked last time about, you know, if you do outside, that you only allow a certain density, and that somewhat mitigates. And maybe that's part of that.
But let's not, we'll try to address if we have time or if it's the commission's prerogative here to address some residential. I wanted to make you aware of some of the stuff that when I send you the full link from the city of Ashland, you will see that they did take on some residential approach. And so it's out there. The question is how much similarly and when and what's the timing, because residential, you know, is a subject almost in and of itself. So whether we choose to take that on, we can talk about that, and we can certainly bring something forward because we wouldn't be the first. We can look at what Ashland did.
Good.
So I wanted to move quickly to schedule of campus industrial uses. I think we talked about dispensaries a year ago. We are putting them on the prohibited use. There's nothing in the development standards and the operational standards, I think, that we want to try to recraft in the campus industrial district. It's just not what it was intended for, right? We're clear about the clean industry and what we're doing out there. Likewise, in the Glenwood Riverfront mixed-use plan, generally mixed-use zoning districts, staff was of the opinion that we not mix vertical high-rises, residential, ground floor, parking, all of the things that go into a mixed-use district with any of the manufacturer processing or retail. Some of those things as a secondary use in some of the industrial districts or in the mixed-use commercial zoning, you're looking for a suite of professional uses that serve the people in your employment most of the time if you're doing one of these new mixed-use type buildings or development. And I just don't see this being convenience or service-oriented when we'll have other places where this is a permitted use.
Yeah, many of my Glenwood neighbors to the south of Franklin Boulevard will be disappointed. But,
Ouch. So, at the end of page 5 of 8, you'll see where we started to craft 4.7-177, which is our special use standard section, and we were getting at, as I referred to them, a little bit, you know, redundant, but we were at the middle of 5 again. Medical dispensaries shall be, and there are some standards there, registered, licensed with the city, located on a collector arterial street, fully contained in a permanent building in the community or MRC. So some of that zoning and some of that language will be massaged, but that is one example of a special use standard. So those are the most general. You can get into the prohibitive nature, and I think we will. Under B, you can see where it says, they shall not be located. Regarding, again, this was medical, at the same address as a grow site. Your 1,000-foot buffers as required by statute, in number 2 at the top of 6, within another 1,000 feet of another, again, statutory distance. So we went to 4 at this point, and we had 250 feet in there. That was based on some discussions we had with some industry reps. After talking with the Park District, and we'll talk with them more, and we'll probably ask their participation, and I'll need comments in writing. But I think the discussion is, if this is a place that meets, if not exclusively or directly, it is certainly a place where school-age children congregate. So we had gone to the 1,000-foot buffer, I think, in our discussions, and we can talk about a lesser buffer on some of the non-park facilities. So we'll talk more with the Park District about that split. But I think Commissioner, you were of the opinion as well, in agreement about the definitions. In our code, obviously, we'll have definitions, but do refer to, I think the Bend Code has a real straightforward, nice approach to doing the language on definitions. It includes the statutory citations, but it's very good language.
I think there's an error in number four.
Yeah.
It says 1,000 feet, but then it says within 250 feet.
Oh.
I think you, in my opinion, you should change the 1,000 to 250, but.
Okay.
I guess for what you intended, it should be 1,000 and 1,000.
Bear with me, this was my rough draft, and I was, again, switching from strictly dispensary and adding some language as we went. So that is my mistake. And there may be more, since this is the end of the document, and I will admittedly have not gotten through it exhaustively. So you can see under number five, we had the 50 feet of residential. Any residential zoning district, so to be clear, HDR, MDR included, some MUC, some language may need additional clarification. Additional regulations under C, not have a drive-up window, and provide for secure disposal of all of their unused portions of their product, if you will. D. We were starting to get at the non-conforming use language, and I think we will have to if we do consider some of the daycare language that probably, you know, intensifies the non-conforming use status. It was interesting in Bend, you'll read it, they said they were not considered non-conforming uses. I'm a little mystified by how you do that. It just simply says if anything is in existence on the date of adoption of this, and it doesn't specify legally created or approved or anything else. It simply says anything that's existing is allowed to stay and it's not a non-conforming use. That, I'm going to have to work through some of that language with my planning colleagues to see how exactly they think that works. So it's there and we will refine that language. And then we, E is the couplet, if you will, for the non-conforming use. F was, again, perhaps redundant, but in the interest of clarity and knowing what your requirements are, that was the development review language. So we have that. We have a section for definitions, and that will become much more expanded. It was limited to dispensaries at this time. That's probably the first pass through of the council directed items, where we left off, and some translation into a rough draft. I hope it wasn't too much sausage making and on a rough scale. It's still a general conversation. If you have additional questions, recommendations, if you want to talk a little bit about buffers, I said at the onset that if we could get back a little of the extra time we went through in our last meeting, that would probably not be opposed. But again, we're here to serve you with additional information or what you might think appropriate to bring forward. I think it's fairly clear under industrial we'll be doing some homework. Are there others?
Yeah. Well, I just, you know, I think that I've heard commissioners talk about the setback for parks, and I know that you're going to be asking. I know Bob's not; he's out until the 29th. He'll be back on the 29th. I personally feel comfortable with a 250-foot setback for parks, and I generally get the feeling around the room that is acceptable. Probably the city council would. So I would say that if we hear back from parks folks and they feel like, you know, the park district already has on the books, an ordinance for, you know, no tobacco use, no smoking. I mean, it's been in the news. You know, there is no public use of this, of marijuana anyway.
Right.
I think the primary reasoning for that setback is really for the same reason the schools, because of the amount of kids and those types of things in the parks. So I'm fine with that. I think the setback on the daycare buffers, I don't know why Ben settled on 150, but my sense is that may have come from public input and the sensitivity in the community around, those daycare facilities. Like, people are sensitive about schools and about parks.
Absolutely.
And so there may be, that might be a trade-off type situation. We have, from the looks of this, even with the 1,000-foot setbacks, there's substantial areas for both retail and the other
industrial uses.
So, I don't think we're being too limiting. We'll be able to provide something that is acceptable to the business community as well as the council, the citizens, and have the setbacks we need on schools and the others. So I don't think we're that far away, I guess is what I'm saying. Yeah. That's one commissioner.
I appreciate the feedback. Yeah. The daycare as well. Gentlemen,
good job.
Yeah. Right. We have some code writing to do. I'm sorry.
Oh, I could weigh in on some distances. When not being specific on parks, I mean, there's some parks that obviously get a lot more used by children, and there's other parks like Rough Park or some of the other ones that, not specifically used by children, but I'd be comfortable on a lesser number in general rather than trying to be specific as to different types of parks, because some of them I could see you'd want a greater area. Others I could see that you just consider it like almost like residential. Daycare, I think 1,000 is way too large. I can see that we had the two maps before that had the schools and the daycare, and you could see that there was just a considerable change in the areas.
For daycare.
So I'd be comfortable with either eliminating daycare or much less than what we have under parks.
I'm inclined to agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that daycare touches our emotional heartstrings, but again, we're talking 2 to 4-year-olds, and can't use the product in the facility, can't use the product off the facility. I guess I'm not too worried about. Yeah, there's a little bit of an allure if they put up a fancy, attractive, glowing sign that a 2-year-old looks at that and goes, but.
Once in a while I put it through the lens backwards and think to myself, this is a state licensed use. There are people that recreate this way or they use it medicinally. And if one of these is on the way or on the way back from after you drop off the kids at daycare, and it's a convenience use like anything else in our code, and this is another permitted commercial use or industrial use, once in a while you have to spin it around and look at it again and put yourself in the shoes of the people who use this legally. Because we all have, as you said, it's a gut or an emotional button, but it's also legal use whether it's our chosen use or not.
That's right.
So that's my 2 cents on the soapbox on that one. But I guess from that, once in a while spin it around, too. You know, if you have something there that is a hot button or emotional button or a fear, then what's our worst-case scenario here? And what's the trade-off? What are we getting for it?
We couldn't get a cell tower within 150 foot of our relief.
Be careful with that, too. So you turn around and look at it once in a while, and you don't get the results you want. So thank you.
Cell tower could fall.
That might have been a good.
I remember them.
That might have been a good exercise. I don't want to prolong it any more than you gentlemen, and I'm sensing a pause. So unless you want to, we can talk about the schedule. Frankly, you're going to be on break. Some of us are going to be on break, and some of us are going to be watching the fort. We'll come back. We'll start writing on this code package and get it to a presentable piece, and we'll be doing some supporting findings and staff reports. But we will try to leave it open to the public involvement. We'll try to meet with a couple of our advocates for both business and medical, and we'll proceed. I don't have a date offhand.
I thought we had a regulatory requirement, like a...
Didn't we have a deadline?
Not later than...
Well, type 4 legislative.
I mean, if not, that's fine.
Yeah. Well, the timeline you may be thinking about is that the law for recreational marijuana...
January 1st.
January 4th.
So somebody could come in and want to apply, and we may not have the code to support
the development.
Okay, so
right now they go under regular...
Right. Well, we certainly won't have the code amended by January 4th.
Right.
But as soon thereafter as we can possibly do
it. Site plan, you've got a 90-day window? If somebody will walk in the door?
The January 4th date, to be clear, is... we are to start accepting applications for a land use compatibility statement so that the new recreational users can include that in their application package to OLCC. And we will do an interpretation of standard zoning to allow these things in the basic commercial and industrial zones in the interim. What Mr. Mott, you know, was pointing out is, you know, we are on an as soon as possible kind of time track to minimize the time from January 4 to the time of adoption, so that we're not working off of general zoning, because as we've discussed tonight, there may be some special use standards we want in place as soon as possible. And in the interim, we'll be creating probably non-conforming uses unless we find a way to address that in the process. So we're covered with a somewhat ad hoc approach starting January 4, and as soon as we can get this through the process, the better.
The other thing that applies, and Mary Bridget can reaffirm this, I hope, is that as soon as state law goes into effect and it's applicable to us, whatever provisions are applicable to us, those provisions exist as law, whether they're in our code or not.
Right.
And we have an obligation to abide by state law. So, for example, if the state law said that a recreational retail outlet and a medical dispensary couldn't be within 1,000 feet of each other, then we'd take note of that when we filled out the LUX.
Right.
And to the extent that medical dispensary, if it exists and we know where it exists, and somebody's proposing to put a retail outlet within 1,000 feet, closer than 1,000 feet of that, that would violate the state law, and we'd indicate on our LUX that it violates the 1,000-foot separation standard in state law. Our code doesn't have that standard, so we wouldn't use our code as a basis for our comments. Our comments will either be based on an interpretation of what does exist in our code, or at the very least, default to what the statute says.
Sure.
And until we amend our code consistent with the statute and the allowances in the statute, we're sort of in a gap status.
So the next correspondence, I would hope, will be a list of links for all of this, so you can download it, we can get past hard copies, and, you know, you gentlemen will have that for your use electronically, and then scheduling the next available meeting.
January 20th?
January the 20th?
Unless you want it sooner. Or February 7th.
20th is fine for me.
Put a placeholder on the 20th, and if we can't do that, then this...
Also be during, hey, is something else that night? Verizon Wireless.
Oh, that's right, there is a cell tower that night.
February...
January 20th.
January 20th.
So to allow the writing time, and if it's coming together and we're going to do a public hearing, we also have to do public notice. So we'll review those timelines. Right now, I'm hearing January 20th and February 2nd, so after the break and as soon as reasonably possible.
We may also have a 35-day notice...
DOCD.
Standard with the state.
Right.
So we can't conduct our first hearing any sooner than 35 days. So if we were to send a notice to them on, it's just hypothetically January 4th.
Yeah, so maybe January 20th wouldn't work anyway, right?
Not for a public hearing.
You're in mid-February.
35 days.
We'll send it tomorrow.
Well, we have to send them what our proposal is.
There is that.
So we're not sure exactly.
I haven't done it.
So work session January 20th and then public hearing?
Yeah, that probably...
Sometime in February.
Second meeting.
The second would be too soon.
That'd be too soon.
I'll say February 17th, so it'll be...
Okay, so we're not going to meet on the second?
Well, not for that.
Okay, something else.
The 16th will probably be... Or yes, I'll say one, yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time.
Merry Christmas.
Any other questions or comments?
I don't think so.
I guess we are adjourned then.
We are adjourned.
For the year.
For the year. Take the rest of the year off.